easily deceived. Nimitta is a mental object, and because most people are visual people, it's much better to perceive the nimitta as a light. Sometimes, yeah, it is possible to have it as a feely-feely nimitta, but it can very easily deceive you. It may be just an ordinary feeling in the mind, it's not really the nimitta. So be careful, the feeling nimittas, yes, they can happen, but it's much, much, much better to develop the perception of the light. Sound nimittas, very, very unlikely, or some people say you can. Usually, in most meditation traditions, they always use a light nimitta. So don't try and find a shortcut. Develop the light nimitta. It's not that hard. If you have a perception there of a nimitta, it's not that hard to perceive it as a light. Ajahn, could you explain what Tantra is? Do you practice it? No, Tantra came a long time after the Buddha. It's more to do with Hinduism than anything else. And basically, it's not to be recommended. Sometimes that somebody asks His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and he says, you know, what is required for you to practice tantric sex? And he said, if you can eat a lump of shit without any negativity at all, then you are qualified to do tantric sex. So anyone who wants to follow Tantra, I'll give you that test first of all. If you pass that, then maybe we can do something else. It's something which came about the 12th or 13th century, you know, after, you know, of this era, so a long time after the Buddha, and it was really weird. A Buddhist friend told me a story of how one master saw his student sleeping under a tree. He decided to wake his student up by smacking the soles of his feet with bamboo rods. The student woke up, looked at his master, teacher, smiled, and went back to sleep. Once the student was asleep again, the teacher smiled at the student because he had understood that lesson. I don't quite get this. Can you elaborate, please? I don't get it either. In other words, that's more wacky Buddhism. You don't go around smacking anybody on the soles of their feet. If you tried that in Australia, you'd either get whacked back or you'd be get a letter from the guy's lawyer. That is called abuse. So that's a ridiculous story. People make up all these stories and they've got nothing to do with Buddhism. Do you or can you attain astral travel when you reach high levels of meditation? If so, where do you go? What a waste of time astral traveling. There's nothing out there. It is an emptiness there. Who wants to go to the moon? It's just a desert. So in other words, it's a waste of time. So don't go astral travel. Keep it simple, for goodness sake. This question is going to be very easy this evening, by the standards. So you don't go astral travelling. I know getting to stillness means getting yourself out of the way, but after giving it a go, it seems almost impossible to get the self to let go. I know this is partly because I want the self to get lost. I feel I'll just keep on encouraging the self to stay. Any more tips? Cheers. Yeah, just stay in the present moment. In the present moment, much of you disappears. These are the tricks to allow you to disappear. Who are you? Much of what you define yourself to be is all to do with your past. You are a doctor, you are an engineer, you are a grave digger. It'd be great if we have some grave diggers here. They're really useful people. But what are you? I mean, that's just what you did in the past. Is that who you are now? So too often we define ourselves by the past. If you let go of the past, really let it go, who are you? It's very difficult to pin yourself down when there's no past. And when you stop thinking, giving yourself labels, then who are you? It's very difficult. In fact, when you let go of the past, when you let go of thinking, you are disappearing. Brilliant. So all the things you take yourself to be, all those labels, all that past, who you were told you were, now you can let it all go. That is how we start letting go of the self. and all the things we want to be in the future. Our goals and aspirations are also defines us. I am the aspiring poet. I am the aspiring meditator, whatever else. Don't aspire for anything. Remember, if you start aspiring for things, you get the three aspirations. Aspiration starts. That's followed by desperation, usually followed by expiration. So remember, all aspirations have desperation in the middle, so don't even go for it. So that way, that if you don't have any plans for the future, you let go of the past, you disappear. That's why we trick you into being in the present moment, and all these things you define yourself as just vanish. You're letting go. So just follow the instructions. Present moment awareness, silence. Just watch your breath, and you'll find, after a while, who am I? I'm gone. Brilliant. How many things to watch in an in-breath and out-breath? What you are saying is to watch beginning, middle, and end of the breath, and the space in between in-breath and out-breath, and space between out-breath and in-breath. Am I correct? No, you're not. It is correct. Sometimes breath is very short. I don't know how to do this. All you need to do is to watch, like watch my finger, from the very beginning right to the end. There's so many observations there. Same from the very beginning of an in-breath. Not just beginning, middle and end, that's only three spots. Thousands of spots, all the way in between. So if you want to do that now, close your eyes and just watch one breath. See how many sensations you can notice. There's heaps of sensations. So little by little, you can see more and more and more of your in-breath. So it's not just beginning, middle, end. It's a whole lot. Without any interruptions from the beginning. Lots and lots of sensations. So that's what we're supposed to watch. The whole breath. Dear Ajahn, as a Buddhist, eating meat, fish should be avoided as this encourages killing of living beings, and thereby we observe one of the five precepts. No, if you want to avoid killing living beings, don't eat at all. Because if you eat rice, I would live 9 years northeast of Thailand. Every time they ploughed the fields to make rice, they killed thousands of little bugs on the plough. And all the birds were always following the plough, picking up all these little animals which had been uprooted. So if you really, really, really want to make sure you don't harm any living beings, don't eat rice. Potatoes are the same. Don't eat potatoes. And wheat, I mean, lots and lots of animals die from making wheat, and I haven't even got to carrots yet. So if you don't want to harm any animals, then don't eat at all. That's the only way. And don't drive a car. How many bugs, you know, sort of get smashed on your windscreen when you drive a car? So, number one, you can't leave this place. Number two, you can't eat. And in other words, that your life will depend upon other beings. So your job is to try and limit, as best you can, the harm you enact on other beings. Unfortunately, you can't limit it totally. You try and limit it, but don't eliminate it. Dear Ajahn, vast and round emptiness. A lot of the time during meditation there is sustained awareness of the breath for very few thoughts and relative peace. A few times letting go happens and everything got very bright and blissful. Great! However, most of the time what stops the meditation to deepen is a slight discontent that's not as good as it sometimes gets, and that there's still too much control going on. Why can't I let go of this trying to control? Even so, I can see that this is creating the problems. Just give it time. You can't expect every meditation to be the good one. The story I say is a man who went to work on a Monday morning. And on a Monday evening, he came back home. He didn't have anything to show for his work. He wasn't paid. He still went to work on a Tuesday, worked really hard, and still he didn't get paid. He told his wife, "It's a waste of time going to work. I don't get any money." But his wife ordered him, "Go off to work." So he went to work on a Wednesday. The same thing happened, no pay. On a Thursday, he only went to work because he had nothing better to do. And still he didn't get paid. He said, "Look, what's the point of going to work? You never get paid." But his wife really, really forced him, and so he went to work on a Friday. And on Friday afternoon, his boss gave him a big pay packet. So when he went home, he said, "Darling, I've finally figured out. I'm only going to go to work on Fridays." And you all know the meaning of that silly story is that you get paid on Friday for all the work you did on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday as well. And that's the same with your meditation. Sometimes you meditate and you don't get any peace, no bliss. But the next one, yeah, still nothing. And then you get the paycheck. And you think, "Oh, why can't all the meditations be like this? Why can't all days be like Fridays when you get the paycheck?" It doesn't work that way. So every time you are meditating, there's no such thing as a bad meditation. You're just building up the spiritual qualities of letting go, of wisdom, of mindfulness, of kindness. It didn't work this time, but you're making progress. You may not see the progress, but the progress is there. And then you get your paycheck. Yes! And then you think the next one will have a paycheck as well. No way. You've got to do some more work, okay? And you only get the paycheck because of all the hard work you did on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Understand that. You understand that letting go is something you build up. And every now and again you get the paycheck. "Dear Ajahn, many years ago I experienced a deep insight on your retreat. After many days focusing my mind in the present moment, walking, sitting and sitting, it happened on the seventh day. I sat down, looked at you, and with full happiness and faith I said to myself, 'I want to see what Ajahn Brahm is seeing.' I closed my eyes, focused on my breath. After a short time, all the senses turned off, the hearing, the last to go. Then I became aware the breath disappeared. Not knowing where to put my focus, I looked upwards and saw this massive, brilliant white light inviting me in. I let go a little to see what would happen and was pulled in with enormous power. Halfway in, I realized to go all the way, I had to let go of the self. And I totally freaked out. Oh. With great willpower, I forced myself out. It was absolutely terrifying and I never wanted to go through this again. It felt like my mind was split between sanity and insanity. Now when you talk about Nimittarjana's insight, it still frightens me. 13 years later, but on the other hand, it's left me curious as to what may have happened. Had I been able to truly let go, please elaborate." Oh, you had such a wonderful chance. You don't go insane unless you think I'm insane, and maybe it's the jokes I'm telling you. Maybe. Now this is what happens, you see. Beautiful light, you get pulled in, and somehow or other you just stop. It's a stopping which causes you to go through that fear. Just go for it. Remember what I've been keep on telling you. The fear is the thing which stops you enjoying the peace and the bliss. And you know it was powerful, it was blissful. You're about to get in there, and you got scared at the last moment. So please, next time, don't let that happen. You see a beautiful light, brilliant. Let yourself merge into it and you have the time of your life. You won't. The only bad thing is if you don't go in there. That's a shame. If you have an opportunity next time, please go in there. It's well worth it. Everybody who's ever been into those deep meditations always says what a wonderful thing they are. And they give you great insight, great peace, great happiness, great sense of freedom, and great health as well. So please, next time that happens, go for it. "How do you explain people who do good get negative consequences, but people who do evil get positive fruitions? Is this a law of cause and effect in the true sense?" No, it is false. It is not right. It doesn't happen that way. People who do good, but do you really know those people who do good? Because sometimes on the surface it looks like they're doing good, but I don't know what they're really up to. And that's sometimes why they get the negative consequences, because they haven't been so good. They're on the surface, they're goody-goodies, but if you know what they're really up to, they can be quite negative. So, but people who do evils get positive fruitions, they don't. Many of those people who you think are doing well in life, very, very wealthy people, if you get to know the wealthy, powerful, famous people, they're having a terrible life. Many of them are on really some hard drugs. Now look at that when Michael Jackson, when he died, he was having all that incredible drugs just so he could go to sleep at night. So, he's very wealthy, very famous, but, he had some terrible life. So people who do, what are actually positive fruitions, the good results of karma? They're people, they're not very rich, but they're happy. They're not terribly successful in life. They're just having a nice, calm, peaceful time. So when we realize what is real positive fruitions in life, the good results of real good karma, it's like contentment, happiness, and the simple life is the best life. So don't look for people being rich and famous, big houses and big cars, to think that is the result of good karma. That's usually the result of bad karma. And a lot of times people with those big possessions, they're owned by their possessions, they're not free at all. So people who really do good, they get good results. But sometimes you don't know the difference between the good results and the bad results. Look at a person's happiness and contentment. That is a sign that they've done some good work. Ajahn, samsara sucks. But escape is possible through the Eightfold Path. Doesn't this indicate the universe is fundamentally benevolent and a force for good? Otherwise, no escape will be possible. That's one way of looking at it. But it's not the universe is benevolent, the universe just is. So, samsara can be some troublesome, but if you know how to work the system, in other words, make good karma, then the universe is not so bad. And if you really want to get out of the universe, it's happiness upon happiness upon happiness. That's the way out. The path of bliss upon bliss upon bliss. Just like I used some years ago, the simile of a meteor in the sky, the shooting star. You know enough about the universe. These are lumps of ice usually, whirling around the solar system for hundreds of thousands of years, millions of years, and then suddenly they meet the Earth, the atmosphere, after millions and millions and millions of years. And then you can see them, this beautiful streak of light, as they finally come to their end, the end of the meteor. And that's lived for such a long time, you see its final brilliant ending. And that's like the human being, round and round and round of samsara, round and round, thousands, hundreds of thousands of times. And when they meet the Dhamma, like the meteor meeting the atmosphere of the planet Earth, you meet the Dhamma, and then you start to become brilliant, a shining shooting star, lighting up the night sky, gorgeous, brilliant, a wonderful flash, and then you're gone. I quite like that idea. Anyway, now that you have mentioned it, can I request for a certificate of happiness? I'm going to be in trouble now. In case one day I forget, if you don't feel like doing it for everybody, you do not have to read this out loud. It's a bit late now. You've got me into trouble. Okay, I'll try and make some up in a couple of days' time. What is the relationship between the ability to get animitta and one's past accumulated karma? I think in your book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, you stated a similar correlation when you said that if your animitta is dirty or dull, then you may need to clean up your act. Yes, exactly. So remember, the animitta which you see in meditation is a reflection of your mind, the inner part of you. So when the light comes up, what you're seeing is is your own mind. That's why the ninth stage of the Anapanasati Sutta, you experience the citta, you experience the mind. And the brilliance of that nimitta is a sign of the brilliance of your mind. And here you cannot fake anything, you just seeing directly sort of what your mind is. And if you've been a really good person, if you've been so careful always to close the bedroom door in your cottage and never to pull open the fridge door and make a really loud sound, if you turn on the kettle very gently so no one hears it, if you're really pure hearted, then you will find that your nimitta is very brilliant. But if you're one of these people who bangs the doors and complains about everybody else and never sort of cleans up anything, can always ask stupid questions on an evening or does other stuff. Then be careful when your nimitta comes up. It will look nasty and dirty and smeared and shabby. And it will just not be, it'll be like one of these lights, you know, which need replacing because the filament is all wearing out. So, this is a sign of the purity and the goodness of your heart. And you know, some people are so pure-hearted. They're always willing to help somebody else. They're always so kind. They'll open the door for you. And if you're a bit sickly, they'll come and ask you, do you want a cup of tea? Or tomorrow morning, would you like to have breakfast in bed? And people like that, who are really, really kind, they're just, you know, they're just beautiful people. When their nimitta comes up, it'll always be really, really gorgeous. Why? Because, you know, we all know they're very pure-hearted people. So it is true that the accumulated karma, if you've done a lot of generous donations, keeping your precepts, helping out with people who are much more needy than you are, and you've always been kind and sharing, you'll find your nimitta will be brilliant. I am 48 and have yet to choose a religious path. If Buddhism is a path I would like to take, how do I begin? Okay, first of all, you come to me, then you shave off your hair, give away all of your money, and vow to do whatever I say for this time. Oh, cult. Oh, so I said cult. Oh, cult. Choose a cult. No. You don't choose a religious path. The religious path chooses you. In other words, after a while, you listen to some of the teachings of Buddhism or Christianity or whatever else it is, and after a while you feel, hey, this is who I am. That's certainly what happened to me. I was just reading all the different books on different religions, and when I read my book on Buddhism, I knew I was actually already was a Buddhist. I never knew it before. So find a spirituality which suits you, and if this is who you are, call yourself a Buddhist. It's really cool to be a Buddhist these days. So, you know, if you're a Buddhist and they don't stop you at the airport, you know, if you're a Muslim, then you're in big trouble, have to check this and check that. And if you say you're a Christian, you have to give 10% of your income, which is really, really difficult. If you're a Jew, decide to choose a Jew as a guy, be careful, you have to get circumcised. That turns off a lot of people from... It does turn off a lot of people from wanting to convert to Judaism. So Buddhism is really cool. You don't have to give a tithe, you don't have to give 10% of your income, you don't need to get circumcised, you don't, you know, need to sort of, you know, wear a turban. So it's really good religion. You can just, you know, be cool. There are other advantages to being a Buddhist as well. Dear Ajahn, it is easy to tell ourselves not to expect. However, once one has experienced something, it gets into the subconscious mind. How to get rid of the expectation which is in the subconscious mind? Did you expect that? Now, how you get rid of expectations? Program your mindfulness. In other words, recondition the subconscious. by telling yourself, I will not expect a nimitta, I will not expect a nimitta, I will not expect a nimitta. So this is called programming your mindfulness. So at the beginning of the meditation, you tell yourself this, whatever problem you have in meditation, you know, maybe excitement or sleepiness or whatever, identify the main problem and tell yourself at the very beginning, I will not say get excited, I will not get excited, I will not get excited when a nimitta comes. And you just say that to yourself and it actually works. You're programming your subconscious that when a nimitta comes up, whatever you programmed in will come into effect. If it's excitement, you usually get excited when a nimitta comes up. The program don't get excited, the mind won't get excited. You've retrained yourself. Well, if you get close, there's expectations. Here it comes, here it comes, here it comes. You say, you know, when I get to this stage, I will have no expectations. When I get to that stage, I will have no expectations. When I get to that stage, I'll have no expectations. Say that to yourself 3 times, forget about it, and you'll find the expectations will disappear. It's programming your mindfulness. And if you haven't done this before, a nice little exercise is this evening, when you go to bed, whatever time you intend to get up tomorrow morning, like most of you get up at 3 o'clock, don't you, in the morning? 4 o'clock? 4:30? 5? 5:30. Whatever time it is, say it's 5 o'clock. Set your alarm clock for 5 past 5. So you're not afraid. And when you go to sleep, just before you go to sleep, say, I will wake up at 5 a.m. I will wake up at 5 a.m. I will wake up at 5 a.m. You set your alarm clock to 5 past just in case. And you will be amazed that you will wake up at 5 a.m. 1 or 2 minutes either side. It always works. And it's incredible how well it works. How do you know that? How does your body know to wake up at 5 a.m.? You tell it to, it's in the subconscious, and it works. So that will give you confidence. You can use that same method of programming mindfulness. Any difficulty, problem you have in meditation, program the solution at the beginning of your meditation. I will have no expectations, I will have no expectations, I will have no expectations. Say it clearly, listen with as much attention as you can possibly muster, and then it works. Very easy. Dear Ajahn, I miss the teddy bear. You know, we used to have a teddy bear here before? You know what happened? Somebody took it to auction for the nuns' monastery. So we're looking for another teddy bear. If anybody wants to steal a teddy bear from their grandchild or something to pick it. Now we had a nice teddy bear which we sat up here. And the reason we had the teddy bear there was because in a meditation retreat, too often that people have, they're too serious and they need some loving kindness. So sometimes are those people having a very hard time, they can sit with the teddy bear in their lap. And it's amazing just how you get much deeper meditation sitting with a teddy bear in your lap. So, yeah, I miss a teddy bear too. We have to go, can we get one on eBay soon? Respected Ajahn, in daily chanting it advises us not to be born in this world again. Is this worldly world really not so good? Where is the better world? Yeah, I know. Getting reborn. Do you really want to get reborn again in this world? Imagine getting reborn again. Every time you want something, your mother shoves this dummy inside your mouth. You try to speak, and she shoves something in you. And every time you want to go to the toilet, you wet your pants. And you're trying to get your message across, and no one understands, so you start screaming and screaming because you're in big trouble and your mummy just gets very upset at you. Do you want to go to school again? Really? I mean, go through all those exams all over again. And those of you, you know, been here and done that, do you really want to go and get married? Have another husband? Haven't you had enough? No, thank you. No, this is enough. Thank you very much. So when you actually think about it, do you really, really want to get reborn again? Have to go through all this all over again. And be careful, next time you may not get reborn in a country like Australia, or United States, or Brazil, or Lithuania. You may get reborn in a terrible... I'm going to say all sorts of countries I don't like, but I better be careful here. There's people from all sorts of lands here. But you know, some of the places you get reborn are very, very difficult. Dear Ajahn, could you please explain again how to make the breath beautiful? And how do you want without getting tense today? How do you want without getting tense? Today I tried to get the beautiful breath and rather got second noble truth meditation. Got frustrated. Look, see if you can incline towards the beautiful. When you go outside, look at the flowers. They're beautiful flowers. Don't look at the spiders. Look at the flowers. Look at the beautiful sky up there. You know, don't feel the cold. You know, whatever it is, just incline towards the beauty in life. Yeah, there are problems in life. There are difficulties. But instead of looking at the difficulties, look at the other half of life. Yeah, sometimes people are sick. You know, they may have a cancer. But the cancer is only one part of the body. The rest of the body is okay. Yeah, you know, you may sort of have a motorbike accident and lose a leg. But you've got another leg. That's called a spare. So, you know, you've got plenty there. So please look at the positive side of life. So, you know, even if you do lose a leg, that's wonderful. You don't have to waste so much time on too many shoes. You only need one shoe from now on. So there's many advantages, whatever you happen in life. And when you look at the positive side, you can see the beauty in anything. So the beauty is there for you to look at. But some people are so negative. They get so into sort of being critical and fault-finding. They can see the fault in anything at all. Beautiful retreat center like that. This retreat center sucks. In the afternoon, it's too hot. We should have the aircon on. So we put the aircon on, and then it's too cold. And then the cushions, you know, they're too hard. And you have two cushions, and this is too soft. And then you have no schedule, and say, we want more of a schedule. And then when we don't have a schedule, we say, oh, it's too strict, or whatever it is. People are always complaining, whatever happens. And so that way you will never find a beautiful breath. Instead you say, isn't it wonderful just to be here? Just watching a breath. I've got nothing else to do in the whole world. Just to watch a breath. I've got no boss on my back. I've got no wife, nag, 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 nag. I've got no husband just asking, where's this darling, where's that darling? I've got no kids screaming. All I've got is this little body and mind. I've got nothing to do. Isn't this bliss? So when you develop the perception of the beautiful throughout the day, instead of the perception of the faults, then when you watch your breath, it's very easy to see a beautiful breath. It's a wonderful little breath. So this is where you develop the perception of the beautiful throughout the day. And that means it's there when you have a breath. It will come out anyway, after a while. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I usually fall asleep by listening to the rhythm of my breath, so every time I try to meditate, I find myself falling asleep. As soon as I get into a breathing rhythm, I've almost fallen off chairs and stool several times. Is this normal? Please help. Easy. Again, we have some straps. We can tie you into the chair, called seat belts. That way you won't fall off. We can also get motorbike helmets for your head. So if you do fall off, you will be quite safe. And isn't it really weird? How many of you, when you're meditating, you fall asleep, and when you go into your bed at night, you can't get to sleep? It's really weird. When you want to sleep, you can't. So when you want to be awake, you fall asleep. So use reverse psychology. So when you're meditating, try to go to sleep. And then you'll be awake. Okay, you fall asleep listening to the rhythm of your breath. So what you do is, there are postures, falling asleep postures and meditating postures. And after a while, your body will recognize, yes, I'm following the rhythm of my breath, but this particular posture, sitting on my meditation cushion, sitting in a chair, this is not where I fall asleep. So sometimes a physical posture, psychologically, will tell you, this is not sleep time. Which means you can be awake when you are sitting on your cushion. But if you're on your bed, that reminds the mind, this is sleep position, therefore you're going to sleep. It's not just what you do, it's your physical position will also indicate to your mind what you want the mind to do, fall asleep or keep awake. So that's one thing you can do. And fall asleep by listening to the rhythm of your breath. The other thing you can do is program your awareness to say that, so when you're meditating, yes, I'm going to watch my breath, but please don't go to sleep. I'm going to watch my breath, but please don't go to sleep. Watch my breath, please don't go to sleep. In other words, telling your mind that this is not the sleep time, so don't get confused. You're watching your breath to stay awake, you're not watching your breath to go to sleep. So that might work. So there's a few little tricks, and hopefully those will work. But if you do a lot of present moment awareness and silence, do a lot of walking meditation, because people don't fall asleep when they're going on walking meditation. I've never heard anyone yet bang into the wall as they fell asleep. So far you can keep awake when you're doing the walking meditation. So do more walking meditation, and then use the breath meditation as a support for the walking, and then I think you won't feel so sleepy. The other thing you can do is to use the mantra along with the breath. But use a much harder mantra. Not breathing in peace, breathing out, let go. Not the breathing in shut, breathing out, up. There is another mantra which you can use with your breath, which I think will keep you awake, this particular person. So as you breathe in, you chant to yourself, I will die. As you breathe out, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. Now, that will usually keep you awake. And you can also do that while you're doing walking meditation. Left foot moves, I will die. Right foot, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. That really works. If you're Indonesian, mati pasti. Mati, I will die, pasti, that's for sure. So that's a very good one, Indonesian. Mati pasti, mati pasti, mati pasti, mati pasti. That'll keep you awake. If you're Thai, die, nah, die, nah. I don't know what the other language is, Brazilian or Portuguese, sorry, or in Lithuanian, but I'm sure you can make something up. I will die, that's for sure. Because what that actually does, it really reminds you, you're actually going to die. That's the truth. You can't get out of that. And it makes you a little bit afraid. It certainly wakes you up. And then after you're afraid, and it's waking you up, you get into this, once you go through the fear, it makes you very, very peaceful. You're letting go of things, you're going to die. What are you worried for? So when you realize you're going to die, you can very easily let go of so much stuff. It makes you so peaceful afterwards. It's a great way to detach. It's a death recollection. Anyway, Ajahn Brahm, can you teach us how to learn and have unconditional love, giving without asking for return, a pure heart? Thank you. Yes, I can teach you, and I'm doing it now. All these teachings is showing you to have unconditional love, opening the door of your heart. And okay, you can say that, you can teach it, you can write books about it, but here you're practicing it by having unconditional love to this present moment. With all its stupidness, its tiredness, its restlessness, and everything else which is going on in your mind, let it be with kindness. Unconditional love to this moment. Not wanting this moment to be anything different than it is. That's part of letting go. Loving kindness and letting go are exactly the same thing. That's why yesterday I told about Sam, Atta, Vipassana, Metta the dog, and Anapanasati the cat. No, that was actually a dog, wasn't it? Because actually cats don't go on walks with you. Cats go on walks, but they go on walks where they want to go on walks. So this was Anapanasati the dog. So all those four people, they always go together. So loving kindness goes with the meditation. So when you learn more meditation, your unconditional love grows and grows and grows, and giving away without asking for a return. Again, that's when you're letting go in meditation. You learn how to give to this moment, expecting nothing back in return, not expecting nimittas, not expecting jhanas. You just give your energy to this moment without any expectations. That's what you're learning here. And you're purifying your heart. So you've come to the right place. I'm teaching you how to do this. Stick around and you will learn. You speak with authority on enlightenment. Are you enlightened? If so, what's it like? And is it worth all the fuss and bother? Yeah. That's he who knows doesn't say. He who says doesn't know. So what's enlightenment like, and is it worth all the fuss and the bother? It's no fuss. It's no bother. That's what enlightenment means. No more bothering. No more fuss. Peace at last. Don't you want to have some peace at last? Have you been fed up with all the fussing and all the bothering and all the questions? So that's what enlightenment means. The end of all the fuss. The end of all the bother. Freedom at last. Dear Ajahn, why do monks not eat after 5 p.m? We don't eat after 12 p.m. What have you monks been doing? Okay. Why they don't eat in the afternoon? Because just eating in the morning, we already get fat enough. So if we ate in the afternoon and the evening and night time too, we'd be obese. So this is our way of keeping down our weight. So just eat in the morning. Well, a wonderful way of actually, you know, keeping to a good weight. Just don't eat so often. And also, look, how many hours do you spend in the kitchen cooking? Not just even in the kitchen cooking. Going to the shop, buying the food, preparing the menu, and then hours cooking. And then you put a plate of food on the table and your husband just wolfs it down in 5 minutes and then goes and watches the cricket on the TV. All that effort just for 5 minutes, and they don't even appreciate all that hard work you've been done. So it's a waste of time. So instead, in Buddhism, we just cook once a day. Just once, that's all. So give your husband big meal once a day, which means you only have to cook once, you only have to wash up once, and the rest of the day you're free. Oh, what bliss that would be. So it means actually you have much more time. When you're not messing around in the kitchen and eating. How much time does eating and cooking actually take? When you actually look at it, it takes such a long time. So it's great just getting it all over and done with in one hit. Once a day, one feed a day, that's it. So it's a nice thing to be able to do. So when you go home, tell your husband, darling, from now on you're only going to get one feed a day. Big feed, and that's it. Anything else you could cook yourself. Would that work? Or would you get divorced? So reason why we do it, it means once we've been fed, the rest of the day is totally free. You don't have to think about food. And it means that, you know, the stomach can be free, and so all the blood can actually be in your head instead of going to your stomach half the time. Which means that you can have much more energy, mental energy, for meditation. It makes a lot of sense. Do Buddhists have confession? Do priests can give forgiveness for the sins, and the Catholic Church does? So we give confessions, yes. If you want to come up to me and confess all your sins, then please come up to me, because then I can use that for blackmail to raise funds for my nun's monastery. You know, once I find out what you really got up to, I can contact your wife, and unless you give a big donation to the... No, we don't do confessions. You confess yourself. So you know what you've done. So just let somebody know, or let yourself know, and just let it go. Forgive. You don't need a priest to forgive you. You don't need a monk to forgive you. The only person who can ever forgive you is yourself. And that's so true. You can go up to somebody you hurt, and the person you hurt goes up and says, "Oh, forget it, never mind, we all make mistakes." They forgive you. But does that stop you feeling guilty? You still feel guilty, because the only one who can ever forgive you is yourself. The priest can't forgive you. Remember that story of the drunk going into the confessional? You know, he went into the confession box, he sat in his side, and the priest was waiting for him to say something, and after 2 minutes, the priest knocked. Got his knock on here. To remind him that he was there, and still the drunk was silent. So the priest knocked again. And still the drunk didn't say anything. So the priest coughed. So the drunk could confess, and the drunk actually started speaking. He said, "It's a waste of time knocking and coughing. There's no toilet paper in this side either." He hadn't heard that before. Wow, I told a joke he hasn't heard. So that's why we don't do confessionals. Do ghosts, evil spirits exist? Yes, ghosts do exist. Really bad ghosts. Now I'm on a roll with telling one ghost story. Should I tell the coffin ghost? How many of you have heard the story of the coffin ghost? Most of you haven't. Okay, here it comes. Can we please turn the lights down, please? Very good. This is a spooky story. That's good. There's this one guy, and he went to the Buddhist temple to listen to a talk. And on the way home, he didn't live that far away, so he decided to walk home, maybe only 15 minutes. The problem was, to get home, he had to walk past the cemetery. And I don't know why this is, but in all cities I've been to, they have street lights along the roads, but when you get to a cemetery, the street lights are always much further apart. It's always darker when you get close to the graveyard. So when he started walking in the darkness of the graveyard, or just past it, of course he was a little bit concerned. And he got halfway, nothing had gone wrong, so he thought he was perfectly safe. But just past the halfway mark, he could swear that he heard something following him. And whenever you think that somebody is following you, automatically you always walk a little bit faster. And that's what he did. And whatever it was following him also increased its speed. And that really started to scare him. So he walked really fast. And he listened as whatever it was also walked fast. He was scared to look around to see what it was. But after a few minutes, he couldn't resist the temptation. He looked around, and when he saw it, he wished he'd never done that. Because what he saw following him was not a person, was not a ghost. It was a coffin, a vertical coffin, bumping down the street behind him, covered in cobwebs and soil from the cemetery. Bump, bump, bump behind him. And when he saw that, he couldn't help himself but run as fast as he could. And it didn't matter how fast he ran. Bump, 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 bump. The coffin started catching up on him. He was sprinting as fast as Usain Bolt. Bump, bump, bump. The coffin was catching up. He got to the garden gate of his house. He didn't open the gate. He jumped over it. Bump, bump, bump. Came the coffin right behind him. He got out his keys to open the front door. Bump, bump, bump. He dropped the keys. That's what happens when you're scared. The keys fell on the ground. Bump, bump, bump. The coffin was almost catching up to him. He got out the first key, shoved it in the lock. It was the correct key. He turned the lock, opened the door, jumped inside, and banged the door just as the coffin came on the other side. He could see the coffin through the stained glass of the door window. But he was safe. He was inside. He breathed a sigh of relief. Bump! As a coffin hit the front door. Bump! As the hinges started to splinter. Bump! It was only a few seconds and the front door would give way. He ran up the stairs of his house to the only room with a lock, which was the bathroom. He just got to the top of the stairs when BAM! And the coffin broke through the front door. And the coffin stood there vertical. Look this way, look that way. And saw him at the top of the stairs. Bump, 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 bump. As the coffin climbed the stairs. He ran into the bathroom, shut the door and bolted it. And he could hear, not laughter, this is scary. He could hear, bum, 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 bum. Go right to the top of the stairs. Bam! Against the bathroom door. And he knew if the front door would give way, the bathroom door was no protection. Bam! As the wood began to splinter. And he leant against the wall with his arms spread out. Bump! As the coffin broke through. There was nowhere to go. No other place to run. Nothing between him and his spooky coffin. Bump! As it started to come towards him. Bump! As it was almost upon him. He reached for the only thing he could think of and he threw this bottle of medicine over the coffin. And the coffin stopped and never moved again. Because what was in that bottle of medicine was cough medicine. It stops the coffin. Okay, terrible joke. Thank you very much. But thank you for the silly laughter. That made it much better. Thank you. There goes to Jesus.
In chanting the recollection of the Sangha, please explain what in practicing directly means. What practicing directly means is coming to Jhana Grove and doing a retreat with Ajahn Brahm. That's practicing directly. Does that make sense? It's good enough. Dear Ajahn Bhagwan, sir, can you please explain what is death And at the at that moment, what is happening to one's soul consciousness? Does it leave the body, go to the what do you mean by out of the body experience? Thanks a lot. You'll find out in a short time. Can you please explain about life after death? This is life after death. You're alive. You've died. So this is it. This is life after death. It's proved it, okay? There is life after death because you died before. So here we are. What is reincarnation? This is it again. What do you mean by soul or consciousness? Nothing much. Soul or consciousness, a stream of consciousness. It's getting late and I'm trying to finish this off. How can you prove that there is life after death? So obviously that you're here. Who is going to get a chance to be reborn? You are. Who decides it for us to be reborn? You do. So every rebirth is depending on the good and bad things you did in this life. Who is deciding our rebirth? You are. You decide where you get reborn. It's your fault you got reborn. Don't blame anybody. It's not your mum's fault, it's your fault. Why didn't the Samsak mention the world is why didn't the Buddha mention the world is round if he went to the trouble to say there are multiple universes? Did the Buddha say it was round? He said it was a world system. See underneath. Well, that's because he came to Australia and he could see actually underneath it. You didn't believe the Buddha came to Australia? There's a footprint somewhere, the Buddha. So. I don't know. You use the singing bowl to enter meditations. Are there any other ways of using singing bowls for meditation? Thank you. No, not really. You can try it if you like. But now, the reason I do this, because sometimes, you know, when it's like, seriously, when you're doing a nice meditation, you're just really in deep meditation, you don't want to go bang. That really hurts sometimes. So it's a really nasty way to come out of meditation with a big bang. So this is much nicer when you just do it softly. The singing bowl is much nicer to come out of meditation with a sort of a singing bowl sound. So that's nicer because sometimes if you make a big noise, it's very, very harsh. So I prefer this. There we go. I am enjoying your talks. At least someone is. I was raised a Catholic and turned away from the church in my teenage years. I discovered Buddhism 7 years ago and fell in love with it. I went to Thailand and Burma, was devastated to see how corrupt these countries were or are. Why are countries with Buddhism as a main religion so corrupt? Or is the nature of all organized religions or people? That's a really great question. I mean, one of the reasons is because people don't actually practice their Buddhism. It just becomes rituals. And the meaning of Buddhism is lost. You get things like five precepts. And, you know, when you take five precepts, you're not supposed to have any alcohol. But, you know, the time I've been to places like Sri Lanka, you've seen all these wine shops growing up in Sri Lanka. And people getting drunk in Thailand all the time. It never used to be that way. And even when they take the five precepts, the last time I went to Thailand, I saw people taking the five precepts. They had the hands up like this, so they're taking the five precepts, and they had one finger down. And I'd never seen that before. And so I asked them, what do you mean? Why are you taking the precepts like this? They say, I'm only keeping four precepts today. I've only got four fingers up. They chant all the whole five. And once I started seeing that, of course, you know, I looked more closely, and sure enough, there was one person with two fingers down. And after a while you saw a person with all fingers down. They're still chanting everything, but they're just... Because a lot of times that it's become so taken for granted that they've lost respect for the religion. And for many people it's just going to the temple and offering food or money to the temple is almost like as a bribe to somehow wipe out all the bad karma they did the night before. So that way, it's just, that's not Buddhism. That's just the rituals. And unfortunately, there's not enough good teachers around who actually teach what the real Buddhism is. And when you do find those good teachers, most of them are lay people. And the monks are just sitting in the temples collecting money.
And I'm saying that because I'm a monk myself. I went to Singapore. One of the first times I went to Singapore, they took me to the Burmese temple. And there I saw at the entrance, there was a monk there collecting money and giving people blessings with holy water. And when I went upstairs, there was a layperson teaching meditation. And I thought, this is wrong. It should be the other way around. The monk should be teaching the meditation. And the lay people should be doing all the money business to, you know, collect money for the temple, not the other way around. So there's something fundamentally wrong. So, but there are some very good monks, very good nuns. And you know, I don't mind saying this, you're quite privileged by seeing there's some very good monks and nuns here in Perth. It's one of the reasons why this place is growing so well, because we actually do keep our rules. And it's a great inspiration to see monks and nuns who actually do meditate. They do keep their precepts, and they are really an inspiration for the world. So it's great that we can actually see if we can have this in places like Thailand and Burma. But a lot of it is your fault, the lay people's fault, for actually supporting these bad monks and just spending all the time just going there, building huge temples with lots of gold. And you know what for? Because you think, oh, that's making merit. You know, all of that water we have outside, the bottled water, you know where all that comes from? It's absolutely ridiculous. I've been trying to stop this because about 5 or 6 years, no, longer than that, about 10 years ago, a general in Thailand had a dream that his father or something had come to him in a dream, says, yes, you know, I'm getting all the food and all the clothes because you've been giving food and clothes to the temple, but there's nothing for me to drink. So please, whenever you go and offer food in the temple, please offer some water as well. And this was a general, he told that dream, and so now every person who offers food, Thai people, they also offer bottled water as well. And we get heaps and heaps and heaps of bottled water. And I tell them, we've got a tap. And there's rainwater in there, you don't have to offer that. And even about 6 months ago, somebody gave me gave me a big, I think it was a bucket of requisites. They were making an offering from their dead father, and inside was a small bottle of whiskey. And I received, I didn't know about it. It was actually, it went downstairs and the Anagarikas found it. And so what are you doing that for? It's, oh, because my father, he liked drinking whiskey. And if we don't give it to the monks, it means that my father can't get whiskey up in heaven. And that's the stupidity which sometimes people have. You know, what you offer to monks is not what your father gets up in heaven. So, you know, you just do good karma and share the merits. That's good enough. There's so much stupidity amongst some of the people in Thailand and in Burma, unfortunately, that is corrupting. And so more and more people are turning away from Buddhism. They're not turning to Christianity, they're becoming atheists. No religion at all. Simply because they can't see the purpose in being a Buddhist. They see the monks, and the monks live, you know, wealthy lives, living in great temples, instead of like living in simple accommodation. If any of you go to Bodhinyana Monastery, you're welcome to go inside my residence. And you all know where that is. It's a cave. I sleep on the floor. So you know, even I'm a big famous monk, I sleep in a cave on the floor. So I mean, that's a good example for others. You don't need expensive stuff. You don't find any TVs over in Bodhinyana Monastery. You know, we just live very simply. And that gives inspiration. It'd be wonderful if there were more monks like that in Thailand and Burma, and also nuns as well, to give inspiration in our modern world. Anyway, meditation questions. When you are closing your eyes in meditation, do we have to look down or in between the eyebrows? I always feel my heart beat clearly just after sometimes. Is it bad or good? It's good your heart is beating. But don't pay attention to it. Pay attention to the breath. And when you close your eyes, you don't need to look anywhere. Just let the eyes relax. They can look wherever they want. And after a while, you don't know where you're looking because it's inside the eyelids, and so you don't know what's going on. Actually, I promise I've got some eye shades for somebody later on. So you just close your eyes, see the inside of your eyelids, and then you don't look anywhere. Last question. Why would the Buddha teach extreme forms of pleasure and pain are to be avoided, yet jhana is a pleasure greater than sex? What the Buddha said, the pleasures of the five senses are to be avoided. Not all pleasures, just the five sense pleasures to be avoided, because they're distractions. They stop you developing the pleasure of the mind. So anyone who wants to have a look at that, Arana Vibhanga Sutta, that's Arana Vihari in the corner over there. This is Arana Vibhanga Sutta, not the Arana Vihara Sutta. The Arana Vibhanga Sutta, it says it very clear. You should know how to distinguish pleasure, the pleasures of the five senses and the pleasures of the mind. The pleasures of the mind, the Buddha said specifically, cultivate them, develop them. Even like things like inspiration. If you get very inspired, you hear a teaching which really gets to your heart, you think, wow, this is beautiful, this really makes sense. Enjoy that pleasure of inspiration. If you see someone being really compassionate and kind, it really sort of makes you feel so happy, indulge in the happiness of seeing a compassionate act. And indulge in the happiness of your own mind. Those are pleasures we're supposed to indulge in. Very clear in the Arana Vibhanga Sutta. The other things we're supposed to avoid, especially the extremes of pain, like listening to my jokes for too long, and it's now 9:15. So now to avoid the extreme of any more jokes this evening, so we can finish off for this evening. I hope you've had a good day, and have a wonderful night. A nice meditation. Go outside. It's cool. It's very nice weather outside in the evening time. It's nice and cool. A light little wind usually blows over. And it's very, very pleasant indeed. So please, if you want to do some meditation outside, it's a good time. If you want to go to bed, have a nice rest. If you want to do some more meditation, the place is open for you. And see you in the morning. And have a very good night.